Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. The morning after the first day of Donald Trump's second impeachment trial. And I have to say that it was a lot more interesting than I expected that it was going to be. The dramatic contrast between the presentation by the House managers and the, how do you even describe the attorneys that represented Donald Trump. I put out my newsletter this morning. If you subscribe, actually we gave it to everybody free. The headline is the GOP's jury nullification. A pretty good indication from yesterday that the jury is basically rigged. It's fixed. They've made up their minds. They're not going to be swayed by the evidence or by the arguments, and that's jury nullification. But the first thing I did was saying, look, if you have not watched that 13-minute dramatic video that was presented, just take some time. I mean, you know, when you're done with your breakfast, just watch it. It is disturbing. It is emotional. It's incredibly powerful, but it's important. It's intended to be because, as you know, the Republicans and the Trump world is trying to memory hole what happened a little bit more than a month ago. And it was an emotional high point of yesterday, followed by the eminent law firm of Ramble, Blather, and Shout, LLC. And of course, the first lawyer that stood up after Jamie Raskin delivered that amazingly emotional speech was Bruce Castor, who I said this morning, I wrote that, you know, mere words and even video clips can't capture how weird it was. Because, I mean, he's meandering, he's dithering, he's digressing, he's wandering into these corners of incoherence. And you're thinking, okay, sooner or later, he's going to get to the point, any point. But the folks at the Washington Post put together a little montage, a little bit more than a minute, of Bruce Castor's, I would say, weirdest moments. And there were many. So in case you missed it, here's the legal stylings of the lawyer for the President of the United States, the guy that he chose to put in front of the United States Senate during an impeachment trial, Bruce Castor.
I'll be quite frank with you. We changed what we were going to do on account that we thought that the House manager's presentation was well done. We are generally a social people. We enjoy being around one another. Senators of the United States, they're not ordinary people. And boy, this is a diverse group. We still know what records are, right? On the thing you put the needle down on and you play it. I worked in this building 40 years ago. I got lost then, and I still do. I represent the great state of fill in the blank. I saw a headline, Representative so-and-so seeks to walk back comments about, I forget what it was, something that bothered her. I don't want to steal the thunder from the other lawyers, but Nebraska, you're going to hear, is quite a judicial thinking place. If the individual state legislatures didn't adopt the Constitution, we would not have it. The floodgates will open. As I was going to say originally, it will release the whirlwind. But I subsequently learned since I got here that that particular phrase has already been taken, so I figured I better change it to floodgates.
Bill Kristol, neither you or I are lawyers, but I gotta say that was not Clarence Darrow, right? This is not going to be shown in law schools as a "this is what you should do" sort of thing.
It was. I mean, it is kind of amazing, and I am struck that there's Byron York, a major Trump apologist, I think tweeted last night or this morning, well, you know, he's no longer president, so it's unfair. He doesn't have the White House Counsel's office. The House of Representatives has a big legal staff and able to prepare sophisticated arguments, and he just is this poor guy who has to go find a, you know, whatever lawyer he can get, I guess. But of course, he did really steal, as someone pointed out, was it one of our colleagues maybe pointed this out? Maybe you did. I don't know, Amanda or someone, that, you know, he did sort of grift off $200 million from his supporters over the last 3 months. So presumably, if a decent lawyer had wanted to represent him, Trump would have had the money to hire to pay for that person, even at the high rates of the best firms. And that one, it is interesting, isn't it, though, that no one wanted to represent him. I mean, it does say, it's not like there's a shortage of conservative, Federalist Society, Republican, people who served in Republican administrations. people who served in the Trump administration. I mean, in the way government works, every agency has a general counsel. Leave aside the White House counsel's office. Every agency has a general counsel. The Justice Department has many senior officials. They worked for Donald Trump, but they want to get away from him as quickly as possible. And so none of them, he's got a former, whatever Castor is, what a former Pennsylvania district attorney, I suppose, in Montgomery County. And he's got this other fellow who shattered a lot.
Yeah, no, I mean, David Shane, I think, was, you know, compensating for the marathon of ineptitude by speaking very loudly. And then, of course, for some reason, you know, mangling Longfellow's Building of the Ship, which is one of my favorite poems, and he reads it, and it's like, what was that about? So, no, your point is really interesting, because you think about how many good lawyers there are, how many in the Republican circles, conservative circles, and look, I mean, there are people who make a living chasing ambulances. And Donald Trump is a political ambulance. So yet he couldn't find anyone better than this with all of that money. And this is like the ultimate marketing tool. You know that, you know, whatever happens, you're going to be on national television. People are going to be talking about you. And he ends up with these two doofuses. And look, this is not just, you know, partisan cheap shots here, although we can make some partisan cheap shots. We're not above that. But this seemed to unite a bitterly divided country almost immediately. In fact, I think while Castor was still speaking, Alan Dershowitz, who is a, I think, is it fair to say that he's a Trump turd polisher?
Yeah. To use one of your favorite phrases.
Legal turd polisher, went on Newsmax, and they're saying, so what do you think of the president's lawyer? This is what Alan Dershowitz had to say.
What are you making of Bruce Castor's argument so far? Where is he heading with this?
There is no argument. I have no idea what he's doing. I have no idea why he's saying what he's saying. You know, he's introducing himself. I'm a nice guy. I like my senators. I know my senators. Senators are great people. Come on. The American people are entitled to an argument, a constitutional argument. I suspect will be forthcoming from David Schoen. But this, just after all kinds of very strong presentations on the part of the House managers with the videotapes and the emotional speech by Congressman Raskin, my former student, you get up there and you respond. We know that hard cases make bad law. I probably would have started with that. This is a hard case. This is an emotional case. He did say, and I think very appropriately, that everybody wants to take revenge when they see a horrible event that took place at the Capitol. But then he went off. I just don't understand it.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll bring it home. But right now, it does not appear to me to be effective advocacy. He may know the senators better than I do. Maybe they want to be buttered up. Maybe they want to be told what great people they are and how he knows two senators. But boy, it's not the kind of argument I would have made. I have to tell you that.
Yeah, you could just, you don't even know what, need to listen to the sound of that. Just watch Dershowitz's face. And
I would say that Dershowitz, on the other hand, probably resents not having been asked to make the argument. This would have been a moment of glory for him, and he's a total publicity hound. So maybe there's some personal, he's trying to show that he would have done a better job than Castor, and maybe suggesting to Trump that it's not too late to get Alan to do the arguments tomorrow. You know,
this is interesting because Trump is reportedly enraged by the performance. You kind of wonder whether they're going to come back today. I mean, would it be totally shocking if two other lawyers walked into the Senate chambers today? I mean, there was that one moment where Castor acknowledged that Joe Biden had won the election, which was like, oh, you're not supposed to say that. Does anybody know? I mean, you can imagine. I would have loved to have seen a live feed of Trump watching this in Mar-a-Lago.
I felt like they should have put him back on Twitter for a few hours just so you could see him.
Can we just have like just a little Twitter comeback? And of course, you know, what really made this even more striking, which kind of highlighted the gap, was that this clown show came on right after Jamie Raskin made this remarkable presentation. So he presented this 13-minute video, which you have to go and watch, and then talked about his own experience. And this is really, Bill, this is a remarkable experience. I mean, his son committed suicide, lost his son over the holidays. The day before, he had buried his son, and he came to the Capitol with his daughter. I mean, this guy has been through a lot. And you could tell from his presentation, this was Jamie Raskin yesterday.
And I told my daughter, Tabitha, who's 24 and a brilliant algebra teacher in Teach for America. Now, I told her how sorry I was, and I promised her that it would not be like this again the next time she came back to the Capitol with me. And you know what she said? She said, "Dad, I don't want to come back to the Capitol again."
You know, there's a good piece in The Atlantic by David Graham that talks about why that speech resonated with so many. Is because they shared his sense that what happened on January 6th wasn't just a crime, it was an act of sacrilege. So that was a high point of it. And I want to get to, you know, the result. I mean, obviously, the bad lawyering is not the worst thing that happened yesterday. I mean, the fact that 44 Republican senators voted to throw out this case is much, much, much worse. And I think we got to focus on that. But I guess the only surprise was the fact that at least one senator, Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, was actually listening to these arguments. I don't know that the other ones were. They made their minds up. He was listening to this argument and changed his mind. And this is what Republican Senator Bill Cassidy said yesterday.
I said I'd be an impartial juror. Anyone listening to those arguments, the House managers were focused. They were organized. They relied upon both precedent, the Constitution, and legal scholars. They made a compelling argument. President Trump's team were disorganized. They did everything they could but to talk about the question at hand. And when they talked about it, they kind of glided over it, almost as if they were embarrassed of their arguments. Now, if I'm an impartial juror, and one side's doing a great job, and the other side's doing a terrible job on the issue at hand, as an impartial juror, I'm going to vote for the side that did the good job.
So there actually is a juror who was paying attention. So Bill Kristol, though, so the vote was 56 to 44. If you want to look at the glass half full, it's established a very clear precedent that you can, in fact, have an impeachment trial for an ex-president. But those 44 votes make it extremely, extremely unlikely that Republicans will come up with enough votes to actually convict the president. Your thoughts?
Yeah, unless there are more Bill Cassidys out there who have been sort of keeping quiet, and Cassidy had voted that he had thought the trial was unconstitutional, now he's changed his mind. Other Republican senators could think the following, and certainly the House managers will make this case, and I think it's a good case. Look, whatever you thought about the jurisdictional question, the question of whether it was legal to try an ex-president, someone who's no longer in office, that's been resolved. Now you have to judge the case on the merits. I was trying to think of a good analogy to this last night, and I'm sure they've thought of better ones, hopefully, but it'll be sort of like, the first thing that's argued in a trial is whether the statute of limitations has run out of certain crime, right? Something happened 5 years ago. Is the statute 3 years or 7 years? You know, there are endless, obviously, you know, complications of that sort in trials, sometimes ambiguity in the statutes, two different statutes. And once that's resolved, however, if you're a judge or a juror, you have to get to the merits. I mean, you may have thought the statute of limitations had run, but you don't vote. You can't judge someone innocent if, in fact, it has been found that the trial is now moving ahead appropriately. Will more than a few take that attitude? That's, I think, a huge question. I think the House managers will try to hammer this today that you need now to make a judgment on the merits. And the merits are pretty overwhelming. And Cassidy does show that maybe there is so lurking in the Republican conference. There are some senators who have been keeping pretty quiet, but are open to doing the right thing. Cassidy, I believe, was reelected this year, so he's got 6 years till he faces the voters again, if he chooses to. There are other senators in similar positions. There are senators retiring. It's very unlikely that the final vote will be very different from 56-44 or 55-45 or something like that, but it's not totally impossible that the dynamics of the next 2 or 3 days, you know, lead to more Bill Cassidys.
Yeah, 56 to 44. You know, here's a completely irrelevant piece of trivia about this. I was really struck by this, that the vote of 56 to 44 exactly mirrors public sentiment, at least according to the poll that came out yesterday. The CBS polls found that 56% of Americans think that Donald Trump should be convicted. So weirdly enough, the non-representative body of the Senate is right now representing public opinion. There are some reports, I think Bloomberg is reporting, that Mitch McConnell is open to the possibility of voting to convict. I personally reacted to that by kind of snorting and saying, okay, I'm not going there again. But it is interesting that he's still doing that. He's still kind of floating out. It's a vote of conscience. It's a vote of conscience. You know, this, as you pointed out, this procedural question has now been settled. You can vote to say that it's unconstitutional, but now that that's been resolved and we have the precedent set, you know, but I think those chances are slim and none.
Yeah, they are. But I mean, you and I discussed this, I think, last week. Yeah. McConnell did float this notion, you know, right after January 6th, that he was open-minded on this. I think he wanted to see, I don't know what he was doing. Maybe he was just, you know, indicating something and is going to end up where he always ends up. But I kind of wonder if he wasn't trying to see if how many other senators might join him in saying, I have an open mind. The silence was pretty deafening. And McConnell's pretty clever and careful. And you might think he would privately sound this out before floating it publicly, but it's also true that this is such a delicate thing. Maybe you just try the trial balloon and see what happens. And maybe he's letting people sort of know what Bloomberg says. He's letting people know to see if there are other Cassidys hiding there. You can get to 17 Republicans if you just go through the list, add up the ones who, the six that, let's just say for now, have voted against the party, add up a couple of it, a few retirees, a few who aren't up for 6 years, and presumably the next time they face the voters, this will be long, long in the past. A few others who are don't care or in super safe seats or genuine institutionalists. And, you know, it's a little bit of a stretch, honestly, but you could get to 17 votes, and McConnell is the one guy who could get you there, I would say.
Yeah,
McConnell's the guy who could talk to people like Cassidy, who no one much has ever thought much about or heard of much. John Hoeven from North Dakota, I would say, would be in this category. Mm-hmm. People who just might be, you know, be keeping quiet, but are decent people and just can't really stand the idea of voting to acquit when he's so clearly guilty. So, I don't think it's a likely thing. I don't even think it's a 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 chance, but, it's maybe it's 1 in 8, 1 in 10. I don't know.
See, what I thought was interesting about how awful the attorneys were yesterday was it really kind of highlighted the way that both Trump and Senate Republicans are, when they should be rising to this historic moment, are in fact trying to trivialize it, that they're trying to shrink the moment. Remember, we had that quote from Lindsey Graham the other day, was, I have to sit through this crap and everything. Really? This is one of the most extraordinary moments in American history, where the president of the United States, using his power, tried to overturn a free and fair election. I mean, as many times as I say it, and watching that video again, it's like, do we realize the magnitude of this, the danger of this, how unthinkable it is? It happened a month ago, and I'm not sure that everyone has completely internalized what we saw here. You know, this insurrection, this violent, vicious mob trying to attack the Congress to stop them from certifying a presidential election. And Donald Trump, during this whole period, sitting in the White House, not doing anything, on the phone, trying to get more senators to delay the vote. He clearly wanted this mob to help him in his efforts to overturn the election and to hold on to power. It is breathtaking. And to watch the Republicans blow it off and trivialize it. You know, I don't know whether you saw this. Did Mike Lee from Utah, what he said yesterday? Okay, Mike Lee's a smart guy, right? I mean, he used to be one of the more serious constitutional thinkers in the United States Senate. He says, Trump should get give him a mulligan for this. What? There's something about this era that just makes people smaller and dumber.
No, I very much agree.
Mulligan?
And I'm struck, as you say, whether it's Lee or Rubio or Lindsey Graham, they're not defending Trump exactly.
No, they're not.
It's pretty hard to do. It's just a trivializing. We got to move on. This is wasting time where we could be doing God knows what. I mean, not that they've been debating any substance anyway. And you know, Lindsey Graham, when he was still chairing the Senate Judiciary Committee, put off the hearings to confirm the new Attorney General. So it's not as if they're rushing to do work, you know. But I agree that their attitude, well, this is what happens, right? If you have a bad argument to make in an important matter, you trivialize it. That's sort of what happens in human life generally. You just make, come on, this doesn't really matter. We don't have to address this, you know. And I guess they can all get away with this, maybe. And, you know, most likely outcome is a whole bunch of them vote to acquit, 42 of them or something, and maybe 44, 45. And they join the, you know, all the people in the House who voted not to impeach. And that's the bulk of the Republican Party, the huge bulk. Then that case would be, what, 85, 90%. And that will be that, and we move on. I mean, they do have a bit of an opportunity to really make a difference here, and you know, give the Republican Party greater hope of changing course, make this really an inflection point. But and privately, they do all kind of grumble about the fact that a bunch of Trumpists are likely to win primaries next year unless there is an inflection point. So here they have the inflection point. And they're not taking it. I mean, I guess for me, that's what's really striking. And if they don't choose not to take it, it tells you a lot. I do think it tells you a lot about their failure to do their duty in this case. But it also tells you a lot about how they're going to behave over the next couple of years.
No, I think that as an analysis of the damage they will do to the party, that's absolutely correct. But you know, and maybe it's naive to think at some point they might want to put the country over the party.
Right.
Think about the impact of a conviction at this point, what it would mean. And I know they're saying, oh, you know, we're wasting our time. He's out of office. No, actually, the guilty verdict, which by definition would have to be overwhelmingly bipartisan, right, would be this extraordinary historic statement. I mean, it would be a real recommitment to the sacredness of a peaceful transfer of power. I mean, it would make it absolutely unambiguous that we as a country, both Republicans and Democrats, stand against the use and threat of violence to overturn an election, because this is going to set a precedent one way or another, right? If they were to vote to convict, this would be a real marker that there are some things that you do not ever do. No one should ever attempt to lie about an election, overturn an election, engage in these kinds of tactics. It would be a very, very dramatic statement. And I think that it would have the impact of deterrence, because, I mean, there's two aspects of this. You know, number one, you want to hold Donald Trump accountable for what he did in the past, but you also want to deter the Donald Trumps of the future, including Donald Trump himself of the future. Do not ever think of doing this again. You know, the next wannabe anti-democratic fascist out there, you know, at least you have this marker that this is, we are going to take this seriously, and both Democrats and Republicans will stand against you. But right now, it looks like we're going to get a result that Donald Trump is going to spin as exoneration. And I think that's dangerous. I mean, I wrote this morning, I think that if they exonerate him, this is going to happen again. This will happen again, and probably sooner than we think.
And they refused to impeach, or the Republicans, to vote for impeachment or conviction in a year ago when he was still in office. So, I mean, they and gave him a chance to win re-election, and didn't do anything. More evidence has come out on the Ukraine situation with Giuliani's phone calls.
Yes.
They strengthening the pretty strong case already, I would say, for conviction there. So you're right. I mean, the lesson will be do what you want to get foreign governments to intervene in our elections, lie about something so fundamental as election integrity in the U.S., cast doubt on the whole democratic process, incite your followers to riot. Also, incidentally, try to get your vice president to act illegally and unconstitutionally by not counting the returns accurately and by overturning the returns, and pressure Georgia Secretary of State and so forth to act illegally. Do all of that, and you walk away paying no price. I mean, that is pretty astonishing, and I very much agree. It goes way beyond the health of the party. I mentioned it earlier, but that's not a good reason to do it. I mean, I think it would be important if they did it. Might be a bit of an indicator for a Republican Party rethinking. Certainly, if they don't do it, you've got a party that's basically gone along with everything Trump wanted in office. And then some people say, well, but wait till he leaves. You know, then they're really going to rethink. And they're intimidated by him as he's president. He is not president anymore. And they either remain intimidated by him, or they just believe it, you know, themselves, or they want this to be the legacy, or they're scared of the voters, and they feel they can continue to straddle everything. But I think that is feeding the crocodile, sadly. I mean, if they don't repudiate him now, I see very little chance that things don't get more extreme, not less extreme, on the Republicans.
Well, I completely agree. And, you know, also, I think this is the price you pay for the last 4 years of tolerating all of his lies and everything. I wrote a piece the other day for MSNBC Daily, just reminding people about, you know, all the conspiracy theories, all the lies he's told, you know, I mean, starting from birtherism and Ted Cruz's dad being involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy and Joe Scarborough murdering an intern one after another, or, you know, the Osama bin Laden. I mean, this guy's been doing this for so long now, and Republicans have gotten used to. Unfortunately, it's like they're, you know, the analogy I use is like all of their antibodies against crazy and against deceit have been destroyed. So they've gotten so used to it. Okay, yeah, the president, he's lying again. He's lying again. The president of the United States lied about an election and tried to overturn it, and still they've lost the ability to go, wait, okay, wait. There's this massive red line here. We take an oath. We act. What does the? You wrote about this about a year, maybe 2 years ago. You know, reminding people you take an oath. There's a specific thing. You're not just sitting there, you know, on cable news. You're not just doing a podcast. You've taken a freaking oath to uphold the Constitution. Maybe people ought to be reminded about what exactly does that oath mean, and how does that oath change your responsibility from just the average person, right?
Yeah, but they don't. I mean, it is striking that they don't even begin to think that way. And I don't want to romanticize the past. A lot of corrupt members of Congress and so forth, and a lot who did pretty bad things, but. Yeah, I do think there was more of a sense of responsibility, of being a representative, of being a leader, of not just looking at the latest poll in their district or thinking about their primary challenge. And there was a sense that, you know, Burke articulated, 250 years ago, of, you know, you as a representative, you owe your constituents more than just following their prejudices. You owe them your judgment. And in this case, the oath is such a central part of that judgment of what's good for the country. It should be a central part of it. So yeah, no, it's depressing, and it's depressing about the Republican Party. It's sort of depressing about the country. I mean, since obviously Jonathan Last just had a piece yesterday, you know, saying he was bearish or whatever, selling away. You know, he's going short on America. But the true argument there was that, well, if the Republican Party is somewhat responsible, it's one of the two major parties. It's kind of hard to be too optimistic about America in general. Obviously, you could root for the Republicans not to be in power for a long time and work for that, but you can't count on that. So if one of our two major parties is at this level of irresponsibility, we're in bad shape. I just wrote a little thing for Jonathan. I'm not sure. We'll see if he uses it. Sort of vaguely trying to push back a little bit, saying, well, here's what might make one hopeful. But I can't say honestly that I'm wildly optimistic at this point about the future of the Republican Party. For the reason you said, it's partly them just being wrong on this and not willing to face it. But, you know, in a funny way, I respect them more if they just said, look, I've looked at this. He said some stupid things, but I just don't think ultimately the impeachment managers have met the standard of proving with sufficient clarity and insufficient doubt that he is guilty, that he deserves to be guilty. So I'm just going to say it's a close call, and I'm going to say that we should just not acquit him of this charge. I mean, that would at least, I think it would be disingenuous, but it would be, you know, it would be sort of a straightforward account that a juror might give at a trial. Of even if you think someone's guilty, you can't quite get there to vote to convict. But this kind of belittling of the whole process, that for me is, this is a constitutional process. They swore a separate oath to be impartial jurors when they were sworn in as a court of impeachment. They owe the country at least to take it seriously. And instead they're sitting at their desks, you know, doodling and reading newspapers and trying to avoid watching that video, which brings home what actually happened. Not a, you know, made up thing, a fanciful parade of, what do they call it in law, you know, parade of horribles or whatever, you know, actually happened 1 month ago, not 5 years ago, not
this happened to our country
in Kiev. But 1 month ago, in the building, in the chamber that they're sitting in.
So I'm not optimistic about how this trial is going to come out. I mean, I suppose if you were to spin a scenario, you would start with the way that the senators are offended by how how weak the defense of Donald Trump was. I mean, I think that's also something we saw, that he really has no substantive defense, and he's almost going through the motions. I thought Richard Burr's comments afterwards. Now he's leaving, and he voted with the other Republicans, but he said, "I ain't no lawyer, but I know enough to know that was some bad stuff." So you know that they're going, "This is insulting to us. You've insulted our intelligence," and who knows where this is going to go. Now I really wrestle with the same question of, you know, are you bearish or bullish on America? Because I have two completely different takes on all of this, which is that somebody said to me, you know, does the Republican Party know that it's destroying itself by doing this? And I pushed back and I said, well, maybe they don't know that because they think they're doing great. They came right close in the presidential election. They think they did. They gained seats in the House of Representatives, Senate, evenly balanced. They think that this is okay, which suggests that Republican Party can engage in this kind of behavior and really not pay a price, which is a tremendous indictment about our political system.
I think that's such an important point, Charlie, and mm-hmm. I make this point a lot to my liberal friends, moderate friends, let's say non-Republican or former Republican, non-former Republican friends, who are very much in that mode of, don't they understand it's in their own self-interest to stop this? And I think there's some truth to that, and mm-hmm. certainly in the medium longer term. Maybe enlightened self-interest, I think Tocqueville called it, you know, where you look, see above the sort of very short-term, immediate, crass self-interest. But they do not understand the degree to which everyone they know, our liberal friends, you know, just thinks they've gone crazy. And can you believe it? Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Michigan state mm-hmm. Senate leader. But they sit there, they look around them, they picked up a dozen seats in the House. They happen to lose the Senate in a sort of flukish way with the Georgia results, with Trump screwing everything up, but he's going to be gone. So there's still 50-50 in the Senate. I think they have 27 governorships, more state legislative chambers than the Democrats. They kind of control more redistricting than the Democrats. They've got a lot of friendly judges, they think, on the court, but they're by Trump. I don't know how they'll end up. I hope they end up judging, you know, honestly and judicially, but they voted for those judges if you're a senator. And so they're kind of thinking, well, I'll probably get the House back in 2022. Yeah. Hard to tell. 2024, 50-50. Not so bad, not so bad, you know. And so I really agree that they don't see the incentives, the political future, the way a lot of outside observers do, especially outside observers in the media and sort of center-left kind of good government world. I'm not saying the Republicans are right. I'm not saying the outside observers are right. I think it's kind of unknowable. But they're not crazy, the Republicans, if you want to put it this way, to think, you know, not to think it's so obviously in their interest to break with Trump. They think they can straddle the whole thing. They can ride both horses at once. They can have a little wackiness with Marjorie Taylor Greene. They can have Liz Cheney as their number three person in the House. And they can continue. They can do a little better when Trump recedes a bit in 2022 in terms of the candidates who get nominated. And they just have to kind of manage this difficult situation for a while and keep going till 2024. That is their attitude.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And of course, you know, our politics is on a knife's edge. And so what if, and I'm doing this as a what if, I'm not predicting, I mean, what if the pandemic does not go away? What if the vaccine rollout has more problems or is overwhelmed by the new variants? What if the economy begins to overheat or stutters? All of those things, you know, that's why, I mean, if Joe Biden fails, think what he's opening the door for a return to. And totally. Of course, they're counting on the left overreach as well.
I think the Biden success or failure is one of the biggest variables that people aren't focused on. You and I have been on so many conference calls, Zoom calls, mm-hmm. and the meetings, and future of the Republican Party, future of conservatives. A lot of them quite interesting, intelligent people, of course. But one thing that's never meant, I mean, they treat it as if this is sort of a internal debate among Republicans and conservatives, and the future will be decided by these debates or whatever. And they, as if there are no exogenous variables that matter. And I very, very much agree that Biden's success or failure is a huge factor here. If Biden succeeds, then there's a case for decent Republicans to say, look, we're looking crazy. He's doing pretty well. And we need to change our ways just politically. And that happens in American history, of course, when parties are losing. If Biden fails, even if it's not his own fault, it just, you know, gets unlucky with the economic cycle or whatever, mm-hmm. or the virus mutations and so forth, you know, the variants. I mean, then I think you get such a boost for craziness and extremism on the Republican side, probably on the Democratic side too. And then you're really in a nightmare situation. So actually, I mean, it really is kind of important that Joe Biden, I think, be a reasonably successful president. I don't know what successful means exactly, but I would just say getting the virus under control, getting the economy going, no major scandals, a sense of you may not agree with it, you may want to vote for his opponent in 2024, but a kind of pretty competent, pretty responsible attempt at governance.
I actually think it is relatively simple. I think it does come down to the pandemic and the economy. And they seem to understand that, at least that's what I'm getting from them, is that they understand that the process is less important than the results, and that they have to go big. They have to push this out. If they send, you know, these checks out and, you know, accomplish all of this, yes, fiscal conservatives will object to it. But, you know, the harsh, cold reality is that people like getting money. They do. And if, in fact, jobs come back and people go back to their lives, there could be a huge burst of optimism. But we just don't know. It's impossible. Some of it's in his control and some of it's not in his control. So given the fact, and I completely agree with you, that, you know, that our short term political future really does depend on whether or not Joe Biden succeeds. How's he doing so far? What's your report card? You've watched this from inside the White House, outside the White House. You got a report card yet?
Yeah, very incomplete report card. Mm-hmm. But I guess maybe we can close with this incomplete thought. I mean, yeah, I think he's doing pretty well. I mean, look, there are things I would do slightly differently. Times when I thought the message was a little off, or individual members of the administration said things that I wouldn't have quite said. But no, generally speaking, I do very much agree that they understand what matters. He's doing, you know, I'm not a Democrat, or I haven't been a Democrat, and I don't have a great feel for what he feels he has to do to keep certain parts of the party just, you know, from being too restive. And I remember this in the old days with Reagan, there the Democrats didn't sort of understand certain things that Reagan had to do just because his party was his party, even though they didn't end up mattering that much. And I'm hopeful that that'll end up being the case. I talked with a foreign policy expert yesterday who's pretty worried about the world, not because of Biden, just because he thinks people are just generally underestimating all the dangers out there. And that's the kind of thing where he's pretty hopeful that the Biden people have a grip on this, but he's worried that they're not quite, you know, so there's plenty to worry about. But I would say Biden's doing pretty well, better than I would have expected, better than I think most of us would have expected 6 months ago, better than I think that most of us would have expected on November 3rd or November 7th when he was declared the winner, in terms of the coherence of the big policies, the quality of the cabinet, it looks like, the focus on first things first, for all the executive orders people on the, you know, conservatives and Republicans are complaining about. Most of that stuff is not huge, and he seems to be focusing on the big stuff.
You know, I actually spoke to a very, 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 very conservative friend who had actually very reluctantly voted for Biden because they were so disgusted by Donald Trump. And I asked them the same question, and they said, you know, I'm actually kind of proud of the guy. I mean, I'm surprised how competent he is, how fast he's moving. And so even though there's this big drumbeat, like, what do you think now, since he's doing all these things? No, you know what? It's the contrast between Trump is so dramatic. It is so significant. And he seems to be so focused on actually doing the job. I still haven't gotten quite over that. I have to admit, I'm going to go back to disagreeing with him, but I agree. I was impressed. I was impressed that this conservative voter also felt the same way.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Well, that's a good thing to close on. We should close on an upbeat note.
Bill Kristol, thank you for joining us once again on the podcast. Obviously, it is going to be a tremendously interesting and consequential week, and we appreciate it.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.